From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The average medical clinic visit in the United States lasts 7 minutes for return patients. Clicking away at a keyboard, eyes glued to a computer screen, doctors can come off as cold and robotic. But what if artificial intelligence could make the precious minutes you spend with your doctor more human? Cardiologist and researcher Eric Topol envisions a future of healthcare where doctors see algorithms as their work partners. AI could lead to better diagnoses, more care from healthcare providers, but with big data come big liabilities for patients' privacy. Healthcare's AI transformation, in fact, has already begun, and as it progresses, how can physicians and regulators make sure it's done right? This hour on Point, artificial intelligence and the future of healthcare. And you can join us. Physicians, do you see AI making its way into how you practice medicine? Do you welcome it? Could it make medicine more humane? Or could it make you redundant? And patients, do you welcome the deep and vast analytical advances that can come with AI in medicine? What concerns do you have? Could it put more power into the hands of algorithm writers or insurance companies, just to name a few? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us now from New York is Dr. Eric Topol. He's author of the new book, Deep Medicine, How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Healthcare Human Again. And we have a link to an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Dr. Topol is also a cardiologist and executive vice president at Scripps Research and a director and founder of Scripps Research Translational Institute. Dr. Topol, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Meghna. Great to be with you.
It's really great to have you. Can I just first start off with a couple examples that you bring up early in the book about sort of the promises and limitations of how AI will transform medicine? Can you tell us the story of an infant that had kind of unexplained seizures soon after birth and leaving the hospital, and how those seizures were ultimately treated?
Well, that is a great example. I guess that's on point for real. That is, this little baby boy would have died or had very significant brain damage. But the team at Rady Hospital sequenced the DNA of this baby because that's their protocol now for very sick newborns. And using artificial intelligence to analyze this massive amount of data, many terabytes of data, they were quickly, within a 24-hour period, able to get the answer of the causative mutation. And it turned out for this little guy that it was a food supplement, an amino acid that could turn things around. So while he had had status epilepticus of continuous seizures and it was nothing, no medical treatment was working, as soon as they started giving him arginine infusions, the amino acid, everything stopped. He became healthy and has done extremely well in follow-up. So this is one example of artificial intelligence saving a newborn's life, really.
Well, let's talk in a little bit more detail about exactly, you know, what happened in a mere 36 hours, right? Because you say it took 20 seconds for a form of AI called natural language processing to ingest the boy's electronic medical record and determine those 88 phenotype features, as you write, almost 20 times more than doctors had previously summarized in their problem list for this little boy. And machine learning algorithms quickly sifted approximately 5 million genetic variants to find 700,000 rare ones, and then they kept, you know, chipping away until they found the exact variant that you're talking about. And then they treated the little boy. 36 hours later, he was discharged from the hospital and was seizure-free, roughly, right?
Exactly. Well, you know, what you've touched on, though, is the difference between humans and machines. So we, as humans, have early satiety with data. We can't handle that much. Machines have insatiable hunger, and especially when you have the algorithms to analyze a genome in this case. And that's what we're talking about really broadly, is the application of the deep learning algorithms that can take data like this, these inputs, and come up with outputs that are accurate, quickly, and really turn around the problems we have today, which is overwhelming data an inability to cope with it. Hmm. And now we fortunately have a solution at hand.
Well, but on the very next page of the book, though, you give an example from your own practice about the things that AI can potentially miss in terms of critical diagnoses for patients. So can you tell us that story?
Well, I love you, that you brought that up, because throughout the book, I'm trying to get the balance of what AI can do and what it's unlikely to ever do. And so here is an example of a patient, somewhat advanced age, who had very serious lung disease. And he had very severe fatigue, and the lung function was not deteriorating, so there wasn't a good explanation. So ultimately, we did a CAT scan of the arteries. So that's just putting in some dye in the vein in the arm and looking at the pictures of the arteries of the heart. And we saw a blockage, but it wasn't an artery that you would think would be giving him fatigue or be medically important. So I explained that to him, and I really thought in my 30-some years as a cardiologist, this was not going to be of much help, but it was a significant narrowing. And if he wanted to have this addressed, we certainly could do that, because he was really in bad, pretty desperate shape. And since we had no other explanation for what was wrong, he and his wife discussed it, and he decided, surprisingly, because he was so anti any procedures in the prior times, that he was going to have the stent, and he had it, and everything turned around. It was just extraordinary. Now, the point I was making here is that algorithms, based on all the medical literature, would not have predicted he would respond like that. And so, essentially, what we have here is, an unusual situation where the part of the heart that is supplied by this artery had an interaction with a rare condition.
Mm-hmm.
This condition he had, a pulmonary fibrosis. So, that's when you have all the medical literature that someday we'll be able to ingest and help provide guidance to physicians and to patients alike. But all that data is still not going to always be right. There's still going to be the human element, the key to make decisions, making the call. And we're not going to ever get that perfect,
right.
Far from it, in fact.
So I feel like we can't underscore this enough, that thus far, all of the technologies that you're talking about have to rely on extant data, right? Existing information. Now, it makes them wildly successful at being able to digest, every paper ever written about a certain disease. But as you're saying, it can't infer into the unknown. So,
right.
And then you also say, but if we start relying a lot on AI and the artificial intelligence is only giving us outputs and conclusions based on what's already known, that very patient you're talking about might not have, his insurance company might not have approved the stent, because the AI would have said, well, we don't think that the stent is warranted.
Exactly. And that's what we have to really keep in touch with, is that the human oversight and the human bond. And then later in the book, I think, I told a story about my father-in-law who, basically was resurrected. He was made a do not resuscitate. And no one would have predicted that. No algorithm would have had that as a prediction. So that's why we can never fully rely. The health and life are too precious that you don't want to just outsource that to an algorithm. Mm. So there's a helping function that you have already touched on, but there's also that oversight. And that's why these silly notions about, we're not going to need doctors. That's kind of crazy stuff. Because anything that's important, anything that's serious, is going to require the oversight of clinicians.
Yeah. So then why overall are you so bullish on AI and you welcome it into medicine? Because you have a balanced approach in this book, but overall you see it as a transformative force in the practice of medicine. Why is that?
Yeah, well, Meghna, there's a lot of reasons for that. I spent a few years really delving into this topic without the notion of it necessarily helping us, but perhaps making things worse. Because one of the big forces of AI is to improve productivity, efficiency, workflow. So if you do that, well, wouldn't that be just wonderful for clinicians? But the other side of it is that administrators and the business people that oversee healthcare practice could make things worse. They could say, see more patients, read more scans, read more slides, and just where we are today. So, as you know, we have peak burnout among doctors and clinicians, more than 50%, depression, suicide. This disillusionment that's generalized because people working in healthcare are not being able to fulfill the mission, why they went into this in the first place, because they're saddled with data entry clerk work and other things that are can easily be given to machines via voice recognition, for example. So the reason I come out positive is if we stand together, if the medical community become activists for patients and stand up for them, we could get the gift of time here and take advantage of this immense power of AI. But it's not going to happen by accident. And so really getting into this, I realize that this is a once in a lifetime or even multiple generations. We're not going to see this again, likely, for decades, this chance. So we really have to seize the opportunity.
Well, we are talking this hour with Dr. Eric Topol. He's author of the new book, Deep Medicine, How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Healthcare Human Again. And Dr. Topol, when we come back from the quick break that we have to take, I'm going to talk with you about why you call it deep medicine and sort of what the parts of that are. But listeners, we want to hear from you. If you're in the healthcare industry, how have you seen or are you seeing artificial intelligence making its way into the practice of medicine? Do you welcome it or do you have concerns about it? And patients, do you want more AI to help doctors make diagnoses for things that ail you? Or are you concerned that this vast control of information, vast constant analysis of who you are and how healthy you are, could actually make insurance companies more powerful in your healthcare? We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Dr. Eric Topol. He's author of the new book, Deep Medicine, How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Healthcare Human Again. We have a link to an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. And Dr. Topol, we've got some comments coming in online. Susan Nile says, unless this means more human contact for patients, it will translate into a depressing and grim system. And Ark Mundi says, our healthcare system is already too expensive. I doubt the introduction of one more really expensive machine will do anything but make it more expensive. So some cynics online.
Let me take on the cynics, okay? Because they don't understand, I think, the implications just yet. Firstly, if you get the gift of time, which is what we're talking about, which is the most extraordinary outgrowth of the AI era that can be realized, then you have the human touch, the presence, the trust. You restore that precious relationship that used to be there 40 years ago when I graduated medical school, when we didn't have 7 minutes with patients, we had 30 to 60 minutes. And it wasn't the business of healthcare in this country like there is today.
Right. But that if relies on, I don't know, hospital networks, not, as you were saying earlier, not using the opportunity to say, actually, you're going to see even more people.
Well, there's another part of this flywheel, as I call it, that's not just the outsourcing of work from doctors to machines and algorithm. It's also the patient side. And that is so much of the routine, non-serious parts of medicine, like a skin rash or a child with their ear infection, can be done through AI. And not only that, but so much of the data that's going to be generated will be done by the patient herself or himself with algorithms. So that's going to further decompress the time and the burden on physicians. And so then when people come together, then it's because it's significant and it's intimate. And we have this opportunity to bring back the care in healthcare, which is largely missing today. So it's a very unusual opportunity. And the whole reason, the theme of the book is not to be cynical, but in fact, to be excited about what we can derive from this.
But if I may, given the structure of healthcare in America right now, and that, you know, at the heart of it is still it is a for-profit endeavor in this country, what's to stop insurers, hospitals, clinical groups from saying, well, you know, if we can use AI to do some of these diagnoses that you're talking about, why would we even need so many doctors? I don't understand why you, it sounds like you feel that physicians are immune to a fact that is true in every other industry, that when AI comes in, some people lose their jobs.
Well, I'm not questioning that, that is reconfiguration of that. But first, that point about expense. We're talking about software here. This is not expensive. So, yes, if you can reduce the need for physicians, which I actually do think right now that the Association of American Medical Colleges that oversees our medical schools, and our physician over, you know, the whole workforce, they say we're 120,000 doctors short over the next few years. Mm-hmm. And I say, no, we're not short at all. In fact, we may have a surplus. But that is the factor of AI coming in and the things that we've been talking about, Magna. The point being is it's not expensive, and the health systems that can deploy this, that, you know, this is already getting implemented in. I just spent the last year and a half working with the UK to do a review of the NHS that I was commissioned for, working with. That's, as you pointed out aptly, that's not a fee-for-service profit type system. That's a single payer system that works exceptionally well compared to our system with far better outcomes and already is deploying AI. So, you know, I've already seen other parts. We know China is way out in front of AI in healthcare compared to this country. But by seeing these other models in other parts of the world that don't have these perverse incentives, it's easier to be upbeat about where this can go.
Yeah. I mean, look, the China example has a giant asterisk next to it, right? Because China is far less concerned with the privacy of the individuals providing, you know, their bio data to all the AI. I mean, we will talk extensively, Dr. Topol, about the privacy issues that come with this pushing of AI into medicine. But since you did mention China, I want to just, in the spirit of full disclosure, let people know that you're also a paid advisor to a couple of AI health companies, Verily Life Science and Life Sciences, I should say, and Voxel Cloud. You've been an advisor to a couple of other research and insurance companies as well. So, I mean, do you have a conflict of interest here in being, you know, so you're balanced, but pro AI in medicine?
Well, you know, I have a chapter, Deep Liabilities, where I review all the issues about where this can go south. And also, as I pointed out, this could make things worse than we have right now. As far as the conflicts, I mean, I have in the acknowledgments, I list all the associations with companies that I have or have had. I don't obviously think that that has affected my perspective. This is deeply researched with, you know, hundreds of references, objective support. But obviously the reader or the listener can have their own views.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some of the specialties in particular that you find will be very – that AI will be very useful for quite quickly. What are they and why?
Well, the ones that are kind of leading the front are those that are pattern recognition. So, in fact, even beyond radiology of reading scans, the eye diseases are way out in front now. So the ability to diagnose eye disorders of the retina and other conditions, we have seen remarkable deep learning algorithms to process that. Then I already mentioned the scans, and then, you know, next the pathology slide, and then skin lesions, particularly skin cancers. Those are all kind of in the front line as far as lots of data, lots of very promising publications, and those will certainly get very early adoption. But the other one that's pervasive is elimination, liberation from keyboards, from speech recognition. That will affect all clinical encounters, and that will be a welcome change.
Mm. You also talk about how AI very quickly could help tackle a major problem in medicine in the United States, and that is misdiagnoses. What can artificial intelligence do to help that? Because we have, what, just some, more than 10 million incorrect diagnoses in this country every year.
Yeah, actually more than 12 million
a year.
So
yeah.
It's a really big problem. And it's because when doctors see a patient, they have what's known by Danny Kahneman as system one thinking. That is, if they don't think of the right diagnosis in the first seconds of seeing a patient, they're not going to get it. So we have lots of misdiagnoses. If we have machine support, we've already seen how that can markedly improve the diagnosis. And when you start with a patient on the wrong footing, with the wrong diagnosis, all sorts of bad things can happen. Certainly not good outcomes. Unnecessary testing, for example. So, you know, this is a really important area that we will see ameliorated because the essential part of this deep neural network can take data that humans can't see or process. So, for example, a gastroenterologist doing a colonoscopy, there's a very frequent miss of polyps, small diminutive polyps that are quite important for colon cancer. Well, now with machine vision, that's not going to happen. It's going to be exceptionally rare to miss a polyp. There are a lot of pulmonary nodules on a chest x-ray, which could be lung cancer, that are missed by radiologists, but will not be missed by deep learning of films, of x-rays. So the list goes on and on about how machine vision, when it's trained from millions of, you know, whatever, it supersedes human capacity.
Mm. Well, let's go to the callers here quickly. Let's go to Narissa, who's calling from New Orleans. Narissa, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Hi. I was listening at the very beginning, and you were talking about the effects that AI could have on the insurance industry. And I used to be a medical underwriter in Canada in the 80s and 90s. And we were just starting to have the issues of... now that we have DNA and computer analysis of DNA, the fact that you could go and look at people's future medical conditions, are we allowed to base our decisions on what someone now might be able to be told by a computer that they're predisposed to? And what do you do with that information? And how do the insurance regulations and laws affect that? And so that was just my comment. Just how AI probably complicated insurance, but made it better for the insurance company, maybe not so good for the client.
Mm.
I'll listen offline.
Yeah, Narissa, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Topol, this is going to come up again and again because I think it's, you know, in terms of it's the other side of the equation that what may be great in the doctor's office could not be good for patients when it comes to insurance companies and the whole rest of the healthcare field in the United States. What do you think about that?
Well, one of the reasons we have such a mess in the United States is because we overcook. We do too many tests and too many medications. But particularly, that's because we don't understand each individual, the uniqueness, the so-called deep phenotyping. And so we, instead of having all women undergo mammography every year or two, and we know that only 12% of women will ever have breast cancer in their lifetime, now we have the ability with polygenic risk scores, for example, to know who is at risk and who is not. And so when we add this information to what's already known, that's just one example, we can use the tests that we use as mass screening today, or the same medicines that we give to all people that don't work in lots of the ones who are taking it, and be much smarter. And so that's part of this immense data per each person that we're not using today because we're not yet in this mode, but we will be. And it's going to be to the advantage across the board because we're already 18% GDP. You know, we're already at over $11,000 per person in the United States being spent, which is 2 to 3 times more than any other country in the world. And we have worse outcomes than 36 other countries in the developed world. So something has to give with this horrible business model that exists, and insurance companies are not really the solution to the problem.
Who's going to own all that data, though?
Well, as you may know in the book, I get into that in depth. That is, every individual should be a civil right to own all their medical data. That isn't the case in this country, but it has to go there. And the reason it has to go there, Magna, is because you're generating your data. Soon you'll have sensors, not just for steps, but for other important metrics like your blood pressure or your glucose or whatever the condition is you're monitoring or trying to prevent. You also will have your genome sequenced. You don't want to have these data, or you can't have these data, coalesce with your medical record. And not only that, but most people, almost all, have lots of different doctors and hospitals. They can't even get all their data together. What we want in the era of AI is from the time you're in the womb to the very moment that you're trying to assess something, that all that data are input so you can get the best output for guidance. Mm. And so, you know, we have a ways to go, but we're only going to get there if people own their data and it isn't being sold and brokered and stolen and, you know, hacked. We've got to get out of that mode because that's not going to work.
Dr. Topol, when you mentioned that, you know, we can hopefully positively use AI from basically, as you said, the womb to the tomb, that reminded me of a sentence early in your book. Remember how at the beginning of the conversation we talked about that infant boy who had the undiagnosed seizures until he went to that particular hospital that used AI to help process a lot of information about him? I mean, in that portion where you tell that story, you say, few hospitals in the world today are sequencing the genomes of sick newborns and employing artificial intelligence to make everything known about the patient and genomics work together. Now, I was very taken by this example that you gave, but I have to admit, it also reminded me of a particular movie. Can you guess which movie I'm talking about?
Oh, you're going to bring up Gattaca.
I am. Yeah. Because, I mean, right. Look, back in 1997, it seemed like sci-fi, but you're talking basically about this real-life story that mirrors a scene early in the movie. I just want to play this for a second and then ask you a serious question about it. So, 1997, Gattaca, starring Ethan Hawke, and early on in the film, doctors sequence newborn babies' genomes to identify their future health issues. Future being key there, with just a drop of blood. So in this scene, you're going to hear a doctor reading out the medical future of Ethan Hawke's character, Vincent Freeman, just moments after his birth. And Ethan Hawke is narrating.
Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
Neurological condition, 60% probability. Manic depression, 42% probability. Attention deficit disorder, 89% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability. Early fatal potential. Life expectancy, 30.2 years.
30 years.
That's from the 1997 film Gattaca. Dr. Topol, I mean, you are talking about a present and near future where something akin to this might be possible.
No.
No?
I disagree.
Okay.
When I talked about newborn sequencing, I was talking about sick babies in the neonatal intensive care unit, not a healthy baby with output like in that preposterous, you know, Gattaca movie. So, you know, that's a big difference. I'm not saying that all babies should be sequenced. I'm using the technology, which is what this is a really important point of on point here, that you're using the technology for the right reason, the right technology for the right person at the right time. So everything was wrong in that movie, and it gave genomics a bad name, unfortunately.
Well, let me just push back on here. I agree with you. This is about using the technology for the right reason at the right time. My question is, do we have the regulatory environment set up to help guide those kinds of decisions? Or will a company out there who says, look, we can sequence the genomes of babies very quickly, and, you know, parents, we can tell you in advance the kinds of diseases to look out for your child, even if your child seems healthy right now. I don't actually see that as entirely out of the realm of possibility unless we have some sort of common set of rules about what the right uses for AI are.
Well, sure. I mean, we've already seen that with CRISPR, you know, with the China use prematurely, recklessly of using genome editing of human embryos. where I wrote the New York Times op-ed about. I mean, any technology can be misused by rogue cases like that, and AI is a powerful, just like CRISPR genome editing. That's one of the downsides of when you have something this powerful. And yes, you'd like to have the right governance, the right regulatory, but, you know, this is a book which has been written to try to help map that out so we don't have these kind of mistakes and misuse of a powerful tool.
Well, Dr. Eric Topol is author of the new book, Deep Medicine, How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Healthcare Human Again. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Dr. Eric Topol. He's a cardiologist and executive vice president at Scripps Research and the director and founder of Scripps Research Translational Institute. And he's also the author of a remarkable new book. It's called Deep Medicine, How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Healthcare Human Again. And Dr. Topol, I did promise you that you do put forth this kind of roadmap on how to get to this more humane and technologically enriched practice of medicine, the deep medicine, as you call it. And it's got three major parts, right? You call it deep phenotyping, deep learning, and deep empathy. So tell us a little bit more about these parts and how they work together in your ideal future for medicine.
Right, Magda. Well, the first one, deep phenotyping, that's just a fancy term for knowing the medical essence of each person. So that means many layers of data, everything from the person's environment to their DNA and the biology layers. That's, you know, their proteins and RNA and microbiome, and also their physiome, their sensors, what makes them tick, and their anatomy through scans when they're necessary. Every single layer of data, which is their phenotype. So that's many terabytes of data, and it's going to grow as we have sensors on that are monitoring conditions that generate lots of data. So that's a data set that today no human being can interpret. Now, when you use deep learning and you take all those inputs and you take the entire medical literature and you put that all into, you know, these artificial neuron layers, then you get an output. And that is the guidance for either the individual, because they're getting their algorithms like we have today, you know, an Apple Watch that can diagnose heart rhythm. It's the same principle. Mm-hmm. It's monitoring your resting heart rate and your activity heart rate. And when something's off track for you, it gives you a signal that you should check your cardiogram. So that is going to go much more broadly, of course. So that is deep phenotyping. It can be done by a doctor, by a patient on a data set. Now, the deep empathy is derived when you have all that data being analyzed with human oversight, but now you have time, the time to bond, the precious relationship that has been lost and eroded over so many years. And so we have lost that because of the things that have interfered, the business of healthcare, the issues of the keyboards and not even looking people in the eye, the lack of time.
Yeah.
But we know why people went into medicine, and we know what patients want when they see their doctor. And, you know, I start out the book having been roughed up, and I imagine a lot of the people listening to On Point have had either themselves or their family or relatives have been roughed up without care We've got to get that back. And I don't know any other way we're going to have a chance to get it back.
Right. I mean, by roughed up, you're referring to the fact that you had a really bad outcome to a knee replacement surgery. Yeah. And really interesting story. People should look in the book to read that story in particular. But I'm curious, Dr. Topol, in this future of deep medicine, as you describe it here, what are medical schools teaching doctors? Who are the future doctors?
Well, they need to change. That's part of the problem we have, because we have been training brainiacs that have the highest scores on the medical college admission tests, so-called MCAT, and the highest grade point averages in their college. But that's not who really we need to be doctors when you have AI support. You don't need the brainiacs. You need the people who have the highest emotional intelligence, who are the most caring, empathetic communicators. And so we got to breed that, and, you know, we're not doing that yet. But AI is coming quickly, far faster than anyone had projected. So it's time to gear up and also to change the curriculum to those students, those trainees that are going through right now. But there hasn't been anything yet to take that on.
Mm. Well, you know, we have a lot of callers who've been waiting with vast patience here, Dr. Topol. So let me go to them. Let's go to Michelle, who's calling from Sandy Hook, Connecticut. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd respectfully disagree with Dr. Topol. I think it's disingenuous to suggest that AI is going to increase face time with doctors. From personal experience as a retired physician, and I retired early for this reason, medicine is run like a business model now. Small groups consolidate into larger groups. They're all competing for market share. And I believe that AI, as you're suggesting, it would cause, you know, increased privacy loss, increased risk of insurance discrimination. I think there would be more bulk care of patients rather than more face time. As to your last comment about this would let you recruit doctors with more empathy, I think it would do the opposite. Huh. I think it would have doctors just relying on that AI, less face time. I just had to respectfully disagree.
Yeah, I'm happy to respond to you, Michelle. Obviously, you're a disillusioned physician, and that's pervasive. And if you want to just stand by and watch further burnout rates that are already unprecedented high, depression and suicides, and just watch the further deterioration of healthcare, you're welcome to do that. What I've tried to do is to see how a technology, which already is being operationalized in other parts of the world and making a big difference. And so, you know, I think, yes, I already, in the early part of our discussion, I pointed out that it could make things worse. It could make inequities worse, which are already bad in our country. But it has the potential, if we do it right, to be a rescue and make things better. So, you know, you can stay disenchanted and, you know, you retired and so many people are leaving the medical profession because of how pathetic it is right now to be a data clerk and to not be able to care for patients, which is why we went into this in the first place. But that is the reason we need to get it back. And that's what I'm trying to put forward in the book and in the work that I do.
Dr. Topol, if I may, I don't hear Michelle as being an uncaring, disenchanted former physician. I hear her also just kind of pushing back on some of your premises here. I mean,
well,
can
no,
you respond
specifically?
Well, she left because of her personal experience.
Agreed. Yeah, yeah.
But she also asked a specific – she put forth a specific pushback. She says she doesn't think that AI is going to help select for doctors who are more empathetic in the future, but rather perhaps less empathetic because they're just going to rely on what the machines tell them. I just want – would you respond directly to that?
I didn't say that. In fact,
she said that. I just wanted you to respond to it. Yeah.
Human oversight is always going to be important, particularly anything that is a serious condition or potentially serious. No, I think what's missing here is not being familiar enough with the power of the technology and how it can be deployed. When you get rid of keyboards and everything is done by voice and the notes are made synthetically, which is already being done, that's already in clinics in the U.S. and it, certainly abroad. When you get rid of that distraction and you can actually look people in the eye and spend more time with them, it lights it up. It changes everything about the encounter, which is fundamental. So for anyone not familiar with deliberation from keyboards as a starter here, they just don't get it that this has a lot of potential.
Mm. Well, let's go to Bill, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Bill, you're on the air.
Well, thank you. Over 50 years ago, I wrote a monograph about computer applications to diagnosis and prognosis. This was in 62. And got a big silence from the medical community. And about 15 years later, I was talking with a world-class surgeon, very arrogant, which because he's one of the best in the world. And he listened to me, and he said, you know why internists and most medical doctors do not want this to happen? Because they saw what happened to engineering when computers were brought in, and a lot of engineers who were doing PhD work were now being replaced by high school graduates with a little bit of technical training and use of computers. Mm. They said the same thing could happen. I said, well, why aren't you scared? And he said, I'm a surgeon. There's always going to be accidents. There's always going to be wars. And I get to use my healing hands. And anyway, a few years after I talked with that particular surgeon, I met a another doctor who had developed a phenomenal computer system and that I had predicted many years before, and it's called, well,
Well, Bill, actually, I'm going to just take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call. Bill there talking about the differences between at least one surgeon and some internists have. Let me go to Joe, who's calling from New Orleans. Joe, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I am also a practicing physician contemplating retirement. I want to point out that the majority of medicine is actually very ordinary. It does not require genetic testing. It does not need to have a deep understanding of the patient's genetic phenotype. It's really more about things that are very everyday. Over the last several decades, we've had IT intrude into medicine hugely to its detriment, and this has been mostly pushed by ivory tower doctors like your guest today and the IT industry, with the claim that we'll have better outcomes, safer hospitals and encounters, and it will be cheaper. And none of those have proven to be true. To have artificial intelligence then put forward as somehow the savior of doctors, burnout, whatever you want to call it, there's a great YouTube video talking more about moral injury than burnout that everyone should Google, just makes me angry because it's not the solution. Your so-called expert said that doctors get it wrong because they see a patient and come up with an initial or an immediate diagnosis. And I can't believe that a cardiologist wouldn't know the concept of a differential diagnosis. Doctors make an assessment of the patient and then say, what could this be? That's just a basic thing that's taught to every medical student.
Joe, I'm just going to take it back from there because we're running out of time and I would need to give Dr. Topol a chance to respond to what you're saying. So, Joe, thank you for your call. Let's start from the end of what Joe said, Dr. Topol, saying that you, as a practicing cardiologist, he doesn't believe that you understand the idea of a differential diagnosis. I just want to give you a chance to respond.
Well,
to that.
There's a whole chapter about diagnosis in the book, and I review all the data. He has an erroneous conclusion. If a doctor doesn't think of a diagnosis and the differential in the first 5 minutes, the accuracy is 28% of getting it right. Because of this system one thinking, which is reflexive rather than reflective, thinking more, digging deeper. So that's wrong. And I outline in the book about how there has been an epic failure of health information electronic records, which were built for enterprise and the business of healthcare rather than for the patient. And as far as I'm concerned, the current systems that we have, which are totally unacceptable, they need to be replaced by patient-centric systems. and patient ownership of data. So we're in different orbits, the things that he's saying and what I wrote about. And he might want to be a little more open-minded and read the book before he makes conclusions. And a lot of things he just said are not backed up by evidence, which I'm big on. And I'm not an ivory tower doctor. I see patients. I've been in practice for over 35 years. I will continue to see patients. It's the most important thing that I do.
I'm going to presume you use the word epic failure as a pun, given one of the major medical records companies.
Right.
All right. But let me ask you, you know, in our callers, a couple of our callers here, you're hearing deep and principled pushback against this idea of the advantages of more technology in medicine. You write about in the book how medicine has historically been very opposed to forms of technology. I mean, the medical records example is a perfect one. Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of points about this that, you know, medicine has not been adequately data-driven. And one of the most serious diagnoses that we would have to deal with is cancer. And the amount of data of a person with cancer, not only from the genomics of a tumor, the genomics of that person's native DNA, the scans, the slides, there's so much data about the immune system of that person. Multi-layered data is the only way to approach rationally a complex condition. So, yeah, there's certain things that are obviously a lot of things that are routine that it can be handled by algorithms in the future. But the serious diagnosis, whether it's heart disease, neurologic diseases, cancer, those sorts of things, they're going to require this data-driven approach. And humans are not going to be able to do that adequately.
Yeah. You know, we've just got 2 minutes left, Dr. Topol, and we've been focusing a lot on physicians and that side of healthcare and how AI is going to transform what they do. My last question to you is, what should patients do? You know, as we are going to be the people on whom this AI is acting and this new generation of medicine is working on, how can patients best advocate for themselves in terms of how AI is used in their treatment?
Well, the first thing is they should have all their data, which it's very rare to know to see that, because that data is going to be the input for a virtual health coach of the future. And people will be the first. The dream of all has been to prevent conditions. And so there will be knowledge of risk for many common conditions, and there will be actionable things. But people have to have their data in the first place. So that's something that should be hopefully a path to really pursue in the times ahead. But, you know, being open and aware of where we're headed, the idea that, you know, in the times ahead, there's a potential to restore the relationship that is so vital. And as machines get better, which they will, and they're doing it at a pace that is unexpectedly fast, we need to get more humane and get back to the principles of what medicine's all about. And there is a way to do that.
Well, Dr. Eric Topol is a cardiologist and executive vice president at Scripps Research and author of the new book, Deep Medicine: How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Healthcare Human Again. We've got a link to an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Dr. Topol, thank you so very much for a truly fascinating hour.
Thanks. Enjoyed all the challenges.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder, with help from Matt Hoisch, Asil Kibbe, and Alex Pena. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.